Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point, and it is Friday, so thank you for joining us for the Week in Review. Let's dive straight in, and we're going to start by spending some time on the COVID-19 pandemic. More than 40,000 new coronavirus cases were reported in the United States yesterday, a record high number for the second straight day. And earlier this week, on Tuesday, Dr. Anthony Fauci was on the Hill testifying in a hearing on the Trump administration's handling of the pandemic. And the hearing got a little testy when Republican David McKinley of West Virginia tried to pin the blame for a slow start on Fauci.
As late as March 31st, there was no consensus on wearing masks. And the president, as you know, relies on your expertise. Do you now regret not advising people more forcefully to wear masks earlier?
Okay, we're going to play that game. Let me explain to you what happened back then.
Should be a yes or a no.
No, there's more than a yes or no by the tone of your question.
So that's where we'll start our Week in Review. And joining us is Rick Burke, co-founder and executive editor of STAT, the media company that focuses on health, medicine, and science. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Meghna.
So first of all, pick up where we left off there with Dr. Fauci's appearance on Capitol Hill there. What did you make of, first of all, just that interaction between McKinley and Fauci?
Well, I think that's the first time we've seen throughout this crisis Fauci sort of losing it a little bit. And I think that's an example of how out of whack everything has gotten and how bad this crisis is. I think it's a good sort of demonstration of that, because I think when the history of this pandemic is written, I think this week particularly will certainly get a mention. And Meghna, it's all been bad news at every turn. I was looking at we have a tracker of all the states and the countries and where this is going. And I counted 20 states where the infection rate is just spiking. And it's not just a mild, like, gingerly glide up. It's like way up in 20 states. And, you know, example after example of things getting bad. You know, the story just came out this week that that about how bad this is. It's not just the lungs. People who get this can suffer acute kidney injury. They can suffer, you know, it can hit the brain and you can get strokes, psychoses, dementia-like syndromes. I mean, I don't want to be alarmist, but this is alarming.
Mm. Well, I mean, perhaps people have seen on social media or on various news websites, there's a lot of these graphs, Rick, that are comparing the U.S. new case rate to other countries, several European Union countries, for example. And the European Union countries, they're on a really strong downward slope here, but the United States overall is spiking up, as you've said. Now, is this because of the fact that we are several weeks into reopening plans across the United States?
I think some of it is reopening. I think people just had sort of magical thinking, as we heard from the president and many governors, that this is fading away, when it's really not. And it strikes me, I mean, this was avoidable, the extent of what we're seeing was avoidable. For example, we had a piece in early June, just sort of how do we avoid making the mistakes again? And there's a lot of advice to the states: prioritize early warnings, pay attention to small numbers, because once cases begin to rise exponentially, it's too late to find the contacts and to find them. Do a better job in minority and high poverty communities, like drive-in testing centers, really? I mean, a lot of people can't drive. And so there are a lot of, and take mild cases seriously. Wear face masks. beef up the strategic stockpile. These things, this is not rocket science, but many, many states weren't following sort of the basic, even a month ago, that could have avoided us getting to this point right now.
Mm. And, you know, we are seeing these spiking numbers in places, to your point, Rick, that that were, you know, maybe they thought they were a comfortable distance away from the early epicenters here in the United States. But, you know, viruses don't follow any kind of magical thinking rules we might apply here. Now,
exactly.
about paying attention to those small numbers, we also have news this week that the Trump administration has a plan to end federal support for some COVID testing sites. I think the White House has confirmed on Wednesday that it's not going to fund 13 testing sites, including 7 in Texas.
Right.
In Texas, the numbers are spiking so high there that the governor has decided to pause reopening plans.
Right. Even Texas, of all places, it just makes no sense. And what's striking about all this is it's not political, I don't think, for reporters or politicians to say we need to test and we need to fund these testing sites. It's just common sense. This is science. This is what needs to be done. And the idea that we can pretend that testing isn't important, that the more tests we have, the more this will kind of go away, that we can pretend this isn't really happening, that just doesn't make sense. And I think what you said about the EU and, you know, they're talking about excluding Americans coming in is a huge black mark on this country. It's like we're now like in the class of Russia and Brazil European countries don't want them in there because of how they've handled this crisis. And there's a reason why it's spiking in the U.S. and not in many, many other countries.
So but the reasons are the things that you've been covering at STAT for months and we've been talking on this show. There aren't any new reasons, right?
There aren't any new reasons. And the other thing you mentioned is I do think we're seeing a real increase in younger people who are
right.
affected by this because a lot of they're asymptomatic, so they don't know they have something. And I think there's a sense of, oh, I'm never going to get touched by this. But younger people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s are growingly, I mean, we're seeing more and more, they can get really, really sick from this. And I think there's a particular fear right now as we go into July 4th weekend that this is really another danger point as we had before Memorial Day. And I think that's why I think the CDC this week, who's been relatively sort of quiet about giving the public information, sort of stepped out this week and said, wait a minute, let's put your masks on, be careful, don't, you know, they're trying to redouble efforts to warn people.
Can you tell us more about the CDC speaking this week? Because I think also the CDC director, didn't they put out new numbers saying that the actual number of cases might be much, much higher than we think?
Yeah, they said they might be much, much higher because they're not doing the testing. And the thing that struck me, Meghna, that really kind of showed that how alarmed they are is you had the director, Robert Redfield, who frankly has hardly had any press briefings during this entire period. And he's been, if anything, rather sort of sedate in his concerns. But he said this crisis has, quote, brought this nation to its knees. And to hear him say that's stop and think about that. You don't hear that from the president, and it's a real disconnect from what his CDC director is saying and what the president is saying, where he's still going to these events where people aren't social distancing and where people are getting infected at presidential rallies. And you have the CDC director saying this nation has been brought to its knees. We're also seeing hospital admissions at record highs in many states in the last few days. I mean, the numbers, as I said at the outset, you at every turn, there's bad news. And I wish I had, the only good news I can give you really is that some of the states, particularly sort of in the East and some of the Midwestern states are seeing certain drops in the spread, and that's heartening. But other than that, this crisis is just getting worse and worse.
Well, speaking of that disconnect, as you mentioned, Dr. Redfield saying this little virus has brought the nation to its knees. The president late last night, tweeted, quote, coronavirus deaths are way down. Mortality rate is one of the lowest in the world. Our economy is roaring back and will not be shut down. Embers or flare-ups will be put out as necessary, exclamation point. Fact check that for us, Rick.
Yeah, I think deaths are still going up. People are dying every day. Hospitalizations are going up. To me, it's irresponsible to play with the numbers the way they're being played with. And the other thing is, and look at the different groups being affected. You know, the one kind of positive in all this is that there's been a sort of advance in telemedicine, so people who can't go to their doctors can get help. But on the other hand, a lot of older Americans and people in minorities don't have access to telemedicine. So they're being left out. And the other thing that I need to sort of mention is that there's another crisis going on, and that's a crisis of chronic diseases. I talked to the head of the AMA this week, and she's very worried that rates are going up in heart disease, cancer, diabetes, because people are not going into the doctors. They're afraid to go in, even when they have chest pains. They're afraid to go in for when they need appendectomies. And this is really a bad situation. So you have a situation where you have these free and easy people who are saying, I'm not going to get it. It's nothing. Then you have other people who are so paralyzed in fright who aren't going in at all to deal with their other medical issues. And this is going to come back at us in a really dangerous way.
Rick, we've got just about 30 seconds left to go. What are you looking ahead to for things that we ought to be watching for next week?
I think we're looking ahead to, are these states going to act responsibly and try to, the states where there are spikes, are they going to sort of try to dial things back and get people to wear masks? That's fundamental. Mm. And especially as we go into July 4th.
Right. Well, Rick Burke, co-founder and executive editor of STAT, the fabulous media company that reports on health, medicine, and science. Rick, thank you so much for giving us the update on the pandemic in today's Week in Review.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, we'll turn to politics when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, so we're doing the Week in the News. And I'm joined now by Darlene Superville. She's White House correspondent for the Associated Press. She's with us from Washington. Darlene, welcome to the show.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you.
It's great to have you. And Nancy Cordes also joins us from Washington as well. She's chief congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, it's great to have you as well.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
Okay, so first of all, since we had talked to Rick Burke about the pandemic, let's just keep with the health theme a little bit here. House Democrats held a press conference on Wednesday slamming the Trump administration for going to the Supreme Court to once again try to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Tomorrow, the Supreme Court will hear the brief from the Trump administration as to taking down the Affordable Care Act, right in the heart of the time of the pandemic. It was wrong any time. Now it's beyond stupid. Beyond stupid.
That's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi a little earlier this week. Darlene, let me just get your quick take here. The Trump administration did indeed argue before the court this week that it feels that the Affordable Care Act should be rendered invalid. Your thoughts on the timing of this right now?
Well, the timing is a little not the best timing, shall we say, coming again in the middle of a pandemic when if the administration succeeds in overturning the Affordable Care Act, you're going to have tens of millions of people without health insurance at a time when they need to be going to the doctor, they need to be getting tested. If it's found that they are infected with the virus or become sick, they need more appointments, hospitalization, treatment, that kind of thing. So it's been the administration's position all along that they've wanted to undo the Affordable Care Act. So that part of it is not surprising that they've gone to the court and are again trying to go this route. It's the timing that is a little bit not perfect in the eyes of those that want to keep the law intact, like Nancy Pelosi and many of the Democratic politicians.
Mm. Nancy, your thoughts?
Well, Democrats would love nothing more than to have this debate drag on through November. They see it as a winning argument for them. Healthcare was the number one issue in 2018, the year that they won back the House, and they feel very good about continuing this debate. Republicans have told us they don't understand why the White House is making the Affordable Care Act an issue right now, because it was clearly a losing issue for them in 2018. And so what Nancy Pelosi is doing to capitalize on this Supreme Court move is she's actually saying, okay, bring it on. You're going to try to destroy the Affordable Care Act. We're going to try to expand it. And so she announced on Wednesday a bill to expand subsidies to allow more people to qualify for coverage under the Affordable Care Act, to enable Medicare to negotiate for prescription drug prices, something that's broadly popular across the country, something the president used to support, but he doesn't appear to support it now. And so they're going to take this vote basically just to – they know it's not going to go anywhere in the Republican-controlled Senate, but it enables them to keep this argument in the news. They know that polls show that the Affordable Care Act is much more popular than it once was. This is a debate they're happy to have, knowing that obviously, given the pandemic that we're living through, healthcare is going to continue to be a big issue right through the election.
Right. And I'm seeing here, and Nancy, correct me if I'm wrong, that the House might even take a vote on this before the 4th of July.
Oh, yes. That's what they're hoping, because, you know, then it just keeps the issue on the minds of voter. They want to draw as much attention as possible at a time when, frankly, people are pretty distracted by everything that's going on around us. They want to draw attention to the fact that this White House continues to try to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. And recent polls have showed that even people who don't have Obamacare themselves are worried about someone they know or a family member losing it losing that coverage during a pandemic. So, this is a fight, frankly, that the Democrats are very eager to have.
Well, let's shift gears here slightly and talk about how the issues of police violence and race in America have really been front and center on Capitol Hill in Washington. First of all, just a couple of clips here to give us a backdrop of why this is so pressingly important in the United States. I mean, first of all, there was that FBI investigation into the noose that was found in NASCAR driver Bubba Wallace's garage in his stall at the Talladega Super Speedway. Now, the FBI investigation said that the noose had been there since 2019, so not a hate crime directed at Wallace himself. But Bubba Wallace was on CNN with host Don Lemon on Tuesday, and here's what he said.
Do you believe that it was intended for you in that way? What are you saying here?
It was a noose. It was a noose that was either whether tied in 2019 or whatever. It was a noose. So it wasn't directed at me, but somebody tied a noose. That's what I am saying. It was. It is a noose.
And at Rayshard Brooks's funeral on Tuesday, you'll remember that he is the black man who was shot while running away from Atlanta police officers. At his funeral, Reverend Raphael Warnock, the senior pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church and a Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate, he said that some people say the circumstances of Brooks's death were different from George Floyd's, but Reverend Warnock disagreed, and here's why.
If your skin is the weapon, and your complexion is the crime, what do you do to stay alive? Comply like George Floyd or run like Rayshard Brooks?
That's Reverend Raphael Warnock on Tuesday. Darlene, these issues that have driven mass protests in America, unlike we've seen in a generation, how much is it front and center in the White House right now? Are they talking about it a lot? Because the president did have his executive order on policing that he signed, but since then has it been a focus there?
Yes, it has been, and it's been a focus also in the context of the legislation and the movement that is happening mm-hmm. on Capitol Hill, in terms of trying to come up with some sort of legislation to address the issues that have driven all of these people into the streets protesting against racial justice, an end to police brutality, and just wanting a change in the racial climate in this country. The White House, the president, has come down in favor of legislation put together with a big lift from Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, who is the only black Republican in the Senate. I believe the White House has said that it would veto a different bill. Some say it's a stronger bill. Nancy Pelosi certainly thinks the House Democratic bill is stronger than the Senate version that got blocked in the Senate this week. But you hear the president also talking about the protests, but not in the context in which the protesters are talking about what they're doing, right? He's talking about it from the vantage point of law and order. We need law and order. We need to reclaim our streets. We need stiff sentences, jail terms for people who are vandalizing and tearing down monuments to Confederate figures and other figures in American history who have a checkered past, who owned slaves, who fought for the Confederacy, those kinds of things. So that's the angle from which the White House is coming at this. You've heard in recent weeks a number of administration officials have been asked whether or not they believe systemic racism exists. And the answer always is no. They do not believe it exists. You get that from the economic advisor, from the Homeland Security Secretary. You've even gotten that from Attorney General William Barr. And it's, yes, the president did put forward an executive order. But when you look at the elements of the executive order, most of them don't really speak again to the issues that have driven, you know, people out into the streets. Yeah. And it's hard. I think it's hard in some ways to solve a problem if you don't think the problem exists to begin with.
Right. So Nancy, let's dig in a little bit more to the legislation that Darlene mm-hmm. was talking about. First of all, what has happened to the Democrats' bill?
The Democratic bill passed on Thursday night. It had universal Democratic support. A trio of Republicans supported it as well. The White House encouraged Republicans to vote against it. So that bill has passed the House. However, it is going nowhere in the Republican-controlled Senate. And at the same time, as Darlene mentioned, the Republican bill was slammed by Democrats this week as being toothless, as being threadbare. They said they're going to block even a debate on that bill. And that sparked a ton of anger and animosity with Republicans, accusing Democrats of wanting to deny their party even the appearance of being able to tackle the issues of race and policing, while Democrats say they're not going to let Republicans get credit for what they essentially see as a bill that's a fig leaf
on this issue. And so for the people who are out there and who have been protesting and who really marveled at how quickly both parties galvanized to craft legislation, it must be incredibly frustrating to see the process break down this quickly and to know that this is, you know, yet again one of these issues that appears, at least right now, to be ending with a stalemate in an election year where nothing gets done despite how badly both parties say they want to make change.
Right. I mean, so a couple of things there, Nancy. First of all, listeners would be forgiven to think it's if they're thinking it's a little rich to hear members of the GOP hue and cry over the Democrats blocking a bill, right? Because I think that happens quite frequently in the reverse. Not to say that I approve of it in any way, shape, or form, because these are parties that if they've ever needed to work together to do something that actually has a lot of American support, now's the time. Is there any possibility of, I don't know, some like quieter conversations that are going on away from the cameras that could lead to some kind of compromise or finding of common ground between these two bills?
Look, it's always possible. Those conversations are happening in small groups. The problem is that there is such a huge gap between these two bills. And I think a lot of lawmakers fear that if they sit down to negotiate, they can never get to the middle. You know, you've got one bill that eliminates qualified immunity, this legal protection for police officers so that they can't get sued. The Democratic bill eliminates it. The Republican bill doesn't. The Democratic bill bans chokeholds, bans no-knock warrants. The Republican bill finds ways to incentivize police departments to reduce the use of chokeholds, and it wants to study no-knock warrants. But these bills are fundamentally different. And I think there's a fear that if they tried to negotiate, find a compromise, that they would fail. And frankly, I think one thing that's on the minds of a lot of Republicans is that ultimately any kind of compromise would have to be signed by a president who has been so mercurial when it comes to compromises that have been crafted by Democrats and Republicans in the past. And he has said that he supports them only to back away, threaten a veto. And I think nothing would be more challenging for Republicans, especially in an election year, is to go out on a limb on some of these issues and strike a compromise with Democrats only to have the president pull the rug out from under them, as he has done so many times before. And as Darlene pointed out, the way that he has talked about these issues certainly symbolizes and signifies that he's not in the mood for a compromise right now.
Darlene, a moment ago, I think I heard you sort of nodding in assent there. Did you want to jump in?
Well, the other point that I would probably add to this part of the discussion is at this point, too, and some of this goes back to what Nancy was talking about. At this point in the game, we have a president who is focused on one thing, and that's getting reelected, right? We're, what, a few months away from the election. And that is his primary focus. And he that's why I think that you see him, for example, just wanting to just move past coronavirus. Forget about what is really happening out there, but he's very intent on sort of presenting to the public that everything is good and things are getting back to normal. You know, he's going out and traveling and doing rallies and that sort of thing and presenting this image of normalcy. He talks about law and order, which is an issue that helped him in 2016. And now with what's going on with the civil unrest and the protests over George Floyd's death, he gets to present himself that way again. Remember, just a few weeks ago, he gave that speech in the Rose Garden where he declared that I'm your president of law and order. And he brought the National Guard in. He wanted to bring in active duty troops. They're bringing in the National Guard again to help guard monuments around the country. So although the country is at a place where it seems that they want some legislation to deal with these issues, police brutality, racial injustice, etc., the president hasn't quite gotten there. And it's most likely because it's not an issue that works very well with his base.
Yeah. Nancy, did you want to add to that?
I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, it's interesting. Earlier this week, I asked the leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, whether he felt that his party could really attack this issue of race and policing and have the moral high ground on this issue without confronting or even in many cases acknowledging some of the racist language that the president has used, not just, you know, in the past about President Obama, whether he was born in this country or calling people coming from Mexico rapists and murderers. But also, you know, he's using the term Kung Flu now routinely to describe coronavirus, something his own staffers have said in the past is very offensive. So I asked McConnell whether, you know, whether there's a disconnect here between the party on one hand wanting to take the lead on an issue that involves race, and on the other hand, you know, really sort of turning a blind eye to what the leader of the party is saying. And he sort of got his hackles up and said, well, you know, every week, you know, you reporters, you want to get me to contradict this president, and I have nothing to add on that. And that's sort of been his posture. He needs to tie himself to the president in many ways to be successful on the issues that he cares about that go beyond race and policing. And so, no, we haven't sort of seen that moral clarity from Republicans. And I think it's an example of another challenge that they face, even as they say that they really do want to make a difference on this issue, and they insist that they've been working in good faith to try to put forth legislation that would address it.
Hmm. Well, we are going over the week in review today. I'm joined by Nancy Cordes and Darlene Superville. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On Monday, we are going to be talking about the impact that the coronavirus pandemic is and will have on this presidential election season. So has President Trump's response to the coronavirus pandemic, has that changed your support or lack of support for him? Have the civil rights protests changed how you're thinking about this election? And what's the most important thing to you when it comes to choosing between President Trump and the presumptive Democratic nominee, former President, Vice President Joe Biden? So give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That is for our show on Monday. Today, since it is Friday, we are looking back at yet another big week in the news. And Darlene Superville joins us to help us with that. She's White House correspondent for the Associated Press. And Nancy Cordes is also with us. She's chief congressional correspondent for CBS News. And they're both with us from Washington. And Darlene and Nancy, let's talk a little bit about John Bolton and his book. He's, of course, the former national security advisor, and his book, The Room Where It Happened, officially was published and released to the public this week. Bolton appeared on Stephen Colbert's show on Wednesday to talk about the book, and Colbert asked him how could he possibly have been surprised to discover that the president may not be qualified for the job. And here is how John Bolton answered.
I couldn't believe it was that bad. And I know other people say they saw it from the beginning.
But you're an international negotiator. How could you be naive? You've dealt with the worst people in the world.
You've really insulted me now by calling me naive. I thought it was possible to work with somebody. I thought surely they would want to learn about the complexities of arms control negotiations and that sort of thing. And as I detail in the book, that turned out not to be true.
So, Darlene, the president did not want this book to see the light of day, as we know. How, now that it's out, what has been the response from the White House?
Their response has been absolutely scathing toward John Bolton. The president has called him a wacko, a liar. I think last night in an interview on Fox News, he referred to him as an idiot. The president and those around him have all gone after John Bolton's credibility. Although the book is titled In the Room Where It Happened, they claim that he was not in the room when a lot of the stories that he tells in the book allegedly happened. And so that's been the response. It's the latest in a series of books from people who have worked for the president, worked in the White House, many of them flattering. But this one is unique in that it comes from someone who worked so closely with the president and at such a high level, who left the White House not even a year ago and is out with a book detailing insider stories while the president is still in office. So the response from the White House and from any White House, frankly, would not be a good one.
Mm. Nancy, your thoughts?
Well, you know, John Bolton has managed to infuriate both parties on Capitol Hill. So when you talk to lawmakers about him, you're sort of met with disdain now, no matter who you speak to. Republicans used to have a lot of respect for him and his judgment when it came to foreign affairs. Now they say, well, how can they trust him because he betrayed the president? So that is how they have sort of managed to look the other way, at least publicly, on some of the more damning things that he had to say in his book. Democrats believe what he says, by and large, but they're infuriated by the fact that he is trying to capitalize on this information now instead of coming forward and testifying like so many of his employees did during the impeachment hearings in the House. And then, you know, he relented by the time that impeachment went over to the Senate, but mostly because he knew that Republicans would never vote to bring him in to testify. So, you know, Democrats say they're already looking into some of the allegations that Bolton is making. In fact, they were looking into them even before the book came out, particularly when it comes to the president doing some favors for Turkish officials. So there's a hint that Democrats may be sort of trying to rev up some of these investigations of the president again. But they say they have no interest in hauling Bolton in to testify at this point. They kind of think that ship has sailed.
Mm. Okay. Well, we could actually talk quite a bit about John Bolton and his decisions. I suppose that no matter what, he's going to be happy because of book sales and his advance. But the question is it what's good for the nation? Moving on, though, let's talk about the Justice Department here, because there's been a lot of news swirling around Attorney General Bill Barr, because as people may recall, over the weekend, there was a huge kerfuffle over the announcement that the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Jeffrey Berman, would be stepping down. But then he said he wouldn't. And then Bill Barr said, yes, you will. I'll get the president to do it. There's a lot of back and forth. Ultimately, Berman did step down. But the question was, why did essentially Barr push him out? Now, we did a show on this on Monday, and one of our guests, constitutional scholar Jonathan Turley, argued strongly that Barr was not acting improperly, just upholding the president's rights as the executive. We also had CBS's Paula Reed on, your colleague there, Nancy. And here's what Paula had to say in response.
While he's allocating all these resources, all of these assurances to make sure that the president, the president's allies, the president's personal attorneys' constitutional rights are protected, at the same time, the Trump Justice Department has opened one federal investigation into constitutional policing practices, when the previous three administrations opened 69.
And then also on Wednesday, we had Judiciary Committee hearings talking about the Justice Department, and Texas Republican Louie Gohmert kept interrupting former Deputy Attorney General Donald Ayer as he read his opening statement. Gohmert kept tapping loudly on his desk.
Then we closing, can keep
it needs
noise.
To be said that Bill Barr does regularly lie in ways that impact official action.
Mr. Chairman, there's not order in the room. There's a banging.
No, there's certainly not.
Mr. Chairman, would you have Gene Krupa removed?
The witness will conclude.
That was Wednesday at a congressional hearing. Nancy, what is going on?
You know, that hearing was stunning for a number of reasons, not only, because of the surreal nature of Gohmert and, the other arguments that sort of broke out over how the hearing was being held, but also because you had two current DOJ lawyers subpoenaed testifying openly about their boss and basically saying that Attorney General Barr had put his thumb on the scale of justice repeatedly to help his boss, the president of the United States. That's just something that we don't normally have a window into, to see these lawyers basically coming forward and testifying. And then you mentioned Donald Ayer. That was eye-opening as well. He was the deputy attorney general under George H.W. Bush, who said that he believes that Attorney General Barr poses the biggest threat to the judiciary in our lifetime. He said that Barr is repeatedly interfering in the justice system for the president, and that it's only speeding up as the president gets closer and closer to re-election. And, Magna, Barr was asked about this directly by Steve Inskeep on NPR. Mm-hmm. Are you only interfering in cases that involve the president? Not just Michael Flynn, but Roger Stone, firing Jeffrey Berman. Are there any other cases that you're interfering in this way that don't involve the president? And the attorney general couldn't name any. He said, I'm sure I have, but he really couldn't list any other examples of ways that he has sort of weighed in this way, except when it comes to friends and associates of the president's.
Well, he also told Steve Inskeep, I'm paraphrasing here, about he sees that one of his main duties is to defend the presidency and the Justice Department from what he called a mob, essentially. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned the really eye-opening testimony at that House Judiciary Committee hearing. I want to actually listen to a little bit more. Here's Aaron Zielinski, a prosecutor who worked on the Russia investigation, and here's what he told the committee.
What I heard repeatedly was that this leniency was happening because of Stone's relationship to the president, that the acting U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia was receiving heavy pressure from the highest levels of the Department of Justice, and that his instructions to us were based on political considerations. And I was told that the acting U.S. attorney was giving Stone a break because he was afraid of the president of the United States.
Well, so that was on Wednesday. Darlene, Bill Barr finds himself, or has possibly put, let's say he's put himself in a really interesting position here, because on the one hand, he has complained before about the president and how President Trump's behavior makes his job as attorney general more difficult. But he's also now perhaps, the most consistent stalwart who in support of the president in the cabinet at the moment. So, like, how is this going down in the White House?
I would say the president is happy with it. Remember, let's go back to the first attorney general, Jeff Sessions, who, you know, drew the president's ire by stepping aside from the investigation into contacts between Trump's campaign and Russia. And that was basically a death knell for Jeff Sessions. And I think even last night, the president found a way to call him a name during an interview on Fox News. He did a town hall with Sean Hannity. So the president thought that Jeff Sessions should protect him, should have stayed over that investigation to look out for his interests, not the interests of the United States. And so in getting rid of Jeff Sessions, what he seems to have found in William Barr is someone who is willing to take the steps and do the things that Jeff Sessions wouldn't do, which is look out for the president and behave in ways that lead to perceptions that he is looking out for the president's interests in a number of these cases, and that's kind of where we're at. And so the president is obviously very happy with William Barr. He doesn't pass up an opportunity when the two of them are together at events at the White House or even outside of the White House to compliment him on the job that he's doing and to say what a good job he's doing, so on and so forth.
So we've got several minutes left here. I want to just wrap up by talking about how all basically everything that we've been discussing this hour, how that's all flowing through. Darlene, as you pointed out, the last sort of 4.5 and 5 months that we have ahead of us before the November elections here. So, Darlene, let me just first start with you and get your take on this. The Trump campaign, they had perhaps not exactly the rally they were hoping for in Tulsa, but nevertheless, that is the president's milieu, and they're planning on future rallies, right? I'm seeing at least here Jacksonville, Florida, perhaps, coming up. So, I mean, how is the campaign feeling at this moment?
It's a bit of a mixed bag. Yeah. Obviously, Tulsa was a big disappointment after all of the hype, after this 3-month hiatus in campaign rallies due to COVID and shutting down and just people not doing anything. A million people reserving tickets, the overflow stage because they thought the crowds were going to be that big. So that was a disappointment. And we saw that, excuse me, in the president when he got off Marine One early Sunday morning after returning back at the White House. For a president that is very fixated on his appearance and how he looks, getting off that plane early in the morning with his tie undone and hanging around his neck, shirt collar open, just sort of looking not very happy, says it all. But they are intent on doing more rallies because that is the thing, one of the things, probably the thing the president feeds off of most. He loves to get up on a stage, to get in front of these adoring, roaring crowds that are just cheering at every applause line that he has. One of the things that's under consideration is instead of trying to do more indoor rallies like they tried to do in Tulsa that didn't go over very well, a venue that seats 19,000 only had 6,200 people. So there were lots of empty seats the president was looking at that fed into his unhappiness. The thinking is that maybe some of these will be done outdoors, airport hangars where there can be some fresh air, more space for people to social distance and that sort of thing. I think it remains to be seen what they're going to do in Jacksonville in August when it's time for him to formally accept the nomination, the Republican nomination for president. But more rallies will be coming. I
they're going to figure out how to do it.
Yeah. And by the way, darling, thank you for correcting me on that when I said a future rally coming up in Jacksonville. Thank you for specifying that it's actually the convention we're talking about here. I suppose my misspeaking there is a hallmark of how this campaign season is unusual, to say the least here. I mean, Nancy, we've got just about a minute left to go. I just wanted to get your thoughts. I mean, because we're going to have a campaign season in the midst of a pandemic, in the midst of historic protests across the United States. I mean, like, just your thoughts on what it's going to look like.
I mean, I think, you know, all you have to do is sort of look at the primaries in Kentucky and New York this week to realize that there's still a lot of work to be done to create a safe and efficient voting system in November. And that leadership is certainly not coming from the federal level. So the states are all going to have to figure this out on their own. We're still waiting for primary results 4 days after the elections in Kentucky. And you've got two presidential campaigns that are themselves figuring out how to position themselves, how to campaign when most people are being urged to stay at home.
Mm. Well, Nancy Cordes, Chief Congressional Correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Darlene Superville, White House Correspondent for the Associated Press. Darlene, thank you so much as well.
Thank you for having me on.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.